suicide, how to spot the warning signs, and get people in crisis the help they need. It's a major public health issue and a leading cause of death in the United States and in Maine, but it's also hard for many of us to talk about. And even when we see a loved one exhibit warning signs, we might not want to confront it, or maybe we just feel powerless to act. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll find out more about how suicide is affecting our society, and how we can become better equipped to help prevent someone from taking their own life. We'll hear from prevention experts on the front lines about how to spot certain behaviors, moods, or comments that may be indicators, and about where to go for information and professional help that can save lives. Preventing suicide, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Suicide is a major public health issue in Maine and the United States. Today we're going to learn more about the warning signs and about what can be done to intervene or find help for people in crisis. In the studio with me, Jenna Maynard. She's executive director of NAMI Maine. NAMI stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Lisa Riley is a member of the National American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP, Chapter Leadership Council. She's chair of the New Hampshire chapter of AFSP and Maine's chapter mentor. And Tracy Charette is with the suicide prevention team at Togus VA Medical Center. And as always, we want to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome all of you to Maine Calling. I guess we'll start, Jenna, with you. And if you could, I guess, assess the significance as a public health problem. How significant is suicide amongst all of the public health issues we have?
Well, we lose a Mainer to suicide every day and a half. So that's really significant. And in fact, in 2014, nationwide, we lost more 10 to 14-year-olds to suicide than to traffic fatalities. So it is heartbreaking. It is a public health epidemic, and we all need to be talking about it and figuring out how can we ensure that no matter whether you're an adolescent or an elderly person or a middle-aged man struggling, those are the highest rates in terms of age, that you have the support you need and know who to turn to be able to stay connected to the people who love you.
Are there any trends, say, over the last 10 years? Has the issue changed in any way? Increased, decreased, demographic changes? What?
Well, I definitely think there are demographic changes in terms of increased attempts by adolescent girls. The fact that, you know, we really see in Maine, we lead New England for the suicide rate for middle-aged men, which is really concerning in terms of that's a population that often isn't even connected to a primary care doctor in terms of a help-seeking behavior, somewhere to turn. So recognizing that we're also talking about middle school suicide. We've talked about adolescent suicide for decades, but middle school suicide is pretty alarming. So in Maine, we have a lot of conversations about those issues, as well as obviously populations like veterans and law enforcement. Law enforcement is a conversation that often doesn't happen, but is a conversation that needs to happen.
And we'll get to veterans more specifically in a moment. But Lisa Riley, what can we say nationally? Does Maine mirror what's happening in the rest of the country or in New England?
Unfortunately, Maine is higher in terms of rate per population. So the national average for suicide loss in this country is currently about 44,000 lives lost annually. You know, our national rate is just over 13.36, and I think Maine is probably 16, just over 16 per 100,000. So I think that statistic alone really speaks to this need for conversation, for being in a room with these two experts, along with this conversation with Maine in general, is really an imperative.
Let's go directly then to the veterans. There was a recent study showing some trends among suicide among veterans, particularly female veterans. So there is some attention being paid certainly upon this issue with respect to veterans. Is it helping? Is that attention helping? And if so, how?
So I think that definitely we can say that it is helping because we're having this conversation and springboarding off of what Lisa was saying, that of that amount, 42,000, 18 to 20% are veterans. And so we recognize that within the VA, it is our number one clinical priority. And we are really working hard with our community partners, with family members, friends, and other veterans to engage them in treatment. So I think that as we're able to have more of a voice, to have these open conversations about such a sensitive topic, I think that we can start to really let people know that it's okay to come forward and to talk about the issues that are impacting them. And we're going to get more into that with the risk factors.
Sure. You know, the central question, it seems to me, at least as a journalist, but I'm thinking also as a person who's been affected by this and people I've known, the first question is why? Because for most of us, we go through our lives desperately trying to stay alive. And so we may not have any understanding of why someone would want to would take their own life. And realizing it's a very there is no answer. There can be, but we desperately always try to look for an answer. Would we be better off not looking for the answer to that and instead focus our efforts on meeting the needs of the person in the moment?
I think the challenge there is to be present for each other. NAMI Maine does mental health first aid around the state, which really encourages people to be comfortable talking to the people they care about and the people they know about how they're doing and being present for that. My grandfather died by suicide during the Great Depression. My mom was 9 months old. She's 81, still searching for the why. That can torment a family for generations. So, you know, there is no easy why. Instead, really connecting to someone who is expressing feeling hopeless or trapped or really starting to socially isolate and really being present for those hard conversations that as a society we don't want to have. My mom was taught to say her dad died of a heart attack because it was too taboo to speak the truth. And so we really need to be present for each other, ask the tough questions, and really want to hear someone's sincere answer.
But if we treat this as a public health issue, then we're going to have to ask questions about why, right? When we say, well, why is lung cancer on the increase? We're going to look at the causal reasons for that. And when you look at a statistic such as, well, middle-aged white males are this much more likely to do this, we'll want to ask a question about why. Is it okay to ask that question then, Lisa? And are there any answers to that?
It's absolutely okay to ask. In fact, just to kind of bounce off what Jenna said, that there are many survivors or those that are left after a suicide loss. So survivors can be close family members. They can be colleagues. I lost a dear friend and colleague in 2004 to suicide. She was a physician. She struggled with a major depression. And despite really good care, she died by suicide and left a family, a group of friends, a group of colleagues wondering why. And I think that when we're talking about how do we make a change in the tide and how do we move forward and not sit in this is what it is we really do have to find out what maybe brings someone to consider suicide. And I think that's really where AFSP can kind of shed some light as a research organization. Our main goal really is to fund research to find out what people are thinking at that most desperate moment, the minutes while contemplating a suicide attempt. And we also know with our work with survivors that if you've been exposed to a suicide loss, you actually have an increased risk of suicide. So I think what's really cool about what we're figuring out through some of this research is that talk can save lives. So we are really about not sitting in the why and getting lost in that complicated grief, but really coming out of saying, hey, I don't know why my friend, my dear friend Rita took her life, but I can tell you what I do know now. And so there's a movement forward through that.
I'm wondering, though, for veterans and for the VA, you know, the military wants to know answers, you know, not to overgeneralize here, but they're going to want to know what's contributing to this problem. And the simplified version that we all have is, well, it's probably PTSD or it's war experiences that can't be processed. It's survivor guilt. You know, we like to think up a few things and apply that to this, but it's more complicated.
It is, and it's extremely complex. And I think that what Lisa and Jen are speaking to is those unanswered questions. And I think the thing that we focus on is that we understand that suicide can become a way to end incredible pain. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big answer to the why. And then moreover, what we look at from the research, from the experts in the field, is understanding those modifiable risk factors, those things that we can let people know to give hope that we can adjust, that we can work on, that there's treatment, that, you know, things can be managed. It's just that sometimes when people are in that place of crisis, it's very, very difficult to see that, you know, things can get better and there is help out there.
I read somewhere in preparing for the show a blurb in some of the materials that said most people contemplating suicide don't want to die, but they don't know how to sort of deal, I guess, basically. Mm. And so, which was surprising to me and interesting. And I guess that does also suggest that that sort of points to the preventability of this.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. NAMI Maine is the main CDC's training partner for all suicide training across the state. And the fact that going to an awareness training to look for what are the risk factors that you as a family member can be aware of, going to a gatekeeper training, which is a 7-hour training, also more intense around suicide prevention, taking some time to dig into what is a difficult topic, to know how we each can work every day to prevent suicide in the lives of the people that we come across, that we touch, because it is preventable if we have the awareness, the understanding of what we're seeing, but not we don't talk about that as a society. So it's really a shame because it's preventable if we know what we're seeing, but we don't talk about it, so we don't know what we're seeing.
Well, let's talk about some of the warning signs then. Do you want to start
off? Sure. I think some of the warning signs that I always like to talk about is someone who's expressed feeling trapped, somebody who is expressing a lot of hopelessness. In fact, Kevin Briggs, a suicide prevention expert who worked for the California Highway Patrol, used to ask people, so what's your plan for later on today? Really to see where someone's mind is. Someone who's feeling really socially isolated. So I talk about this a lot with parents of adolescents. If your child is just cutting themselves off from the world, or your husband or your brother just starts to really socially isolate and is expressing feelings of being hopeless and not seeing things in a, you know, seeing a future through, that's a time to be really concerned. A really change in mood. All of a sudden someone's doing better when they've been struggling is another significant thing to be concerned about, as well as sort of just somebody who just constantly seems to just be struggling and without a path forward. Are some of the things that we say to just notice, because someone socially isolating or expressing a lot of hopelessness, that those are often things that people know them best are going to see.
But this would be, it seems to me, why it's difficult to recognize this in teenagers, because again, not to overgeneralize, but but you know, teenagers often their moods change, they're mm-hmm. emotional, they might be in tears, they might express helplessness or hopelessness and shut themselves in their room and be isolated. So for teens then, how do we see against the background noise and recognize a real problem?
How great it would be to have a conversation with a teen about kind of mental health issues. I mean, I think for me, where I am in my volunteership with AFSP and my life as an advocate, as a survivor, I've been around long enough to see kind of this change of conversation and how cool it is now to see young people being really comfortable talking about their mental health, talking about, oh, I do see a counselor for depression, or I've been struggling with anxiety. It's so awesome to see that. So I really feel like as adults, as parents, as godparents, as aunts, we need to be comfortable in that environment, that it's okay to say, hey, you know what, I heard that, you know, Jenna's dad down the street has been struggling, he lost his job, you know, how's Jenna doing? I think if we normalize the conversation, this is no different than talking about if Jenna's dad had cancer.
Yep.
If Jenna's dad had a car accident, we need to start treating mental health like health, yep. like yeah. illness.
But we don't do that.
We don't.
In fact, I was listening to a show on the radio today, and someone described it as it was about a national story about this quote-unquote cowardly act, and that's still mm-hmm. going on. It's illegal in some countries.
Sure it is. Yeah.
So that's part of it, isn't it?
Shame, stigma, silence. Everybody who's been affected by a mental illness, a loss to a family member or friend by suicide, they understand what that feels like. It's pretty shame-filled.
Yeah. And so then let's say we're worried about somebody. How do you approach them? What do you say? Just, I'm worried about you? Or are there cases where you – how do you do it?
My favorite line is, I'm concerned about you.
Absolutely.
Because I'm concerned about you. You don't launch into all the reasons why, but I'm concerned about you as a way to open a door, because someone can say, really, Jenna, why are you concerned? Or they can say, I don't care what you think. Like, you are not forcing yourself and not forcing a conversation, but you're letting someone know that you care and that you are there. And if they want to talk, you want to hear them. And I think that's the thing, is some folks get really zealous and want to force conversations. That's not going to be helpful for some people. But making sure they know there is someone who wants to hear them, that's there to hear them, that is and wants to be supportive and recognizes things don't seem quite right, has always been my preferred approach.
I think those open-ended questions are powerful. And I teach to our staff to say, even just a how are you, and to pause and be genuine and allow that conversation to start flowing.
But are there not circumstances, though, where it might be a real crisis and an intervention is called for?
Absolutely. We always want to look at with imminent risk that changes things and how we're going to respond to that. And I was reading a study about, we're very quick in society to recognize the signs of a heart attack. What about, psych ache and the pain that comes emotionally? And we need to respond with the same kind of vigor and get folks to help as quickly as possible.
There's a 3-hour training that's was developed by LivingWorks out of Canada called Safe Talk. And they teach participants, and it's a gatekeeper training, they teach participants to be able to say, Tracy, I've noticed that you've been missing work, you're drinking more than you ever had, you're not showing up to meetings. I'm concerned about you. Are you thinking about suicide? And it's a direct. Honest. It's direct and honest. There's no question. Tracy knows exactly what I'm worried about. And a lot of times you'll hear people's response to say, no, not at all. But wouldn't that be ideal to be able to say to somebody, are you thinking about suicide? And to allow the conversation to move forward after that.
And that's absolutely the thing that we all would say that you need to be comfortable with, but yet it's really hard. Mental Health First Aid does something similar mm-hmm. in terms of trying to get people to ask that question. But I'll say, as a mom who's had to ask, starting with, he was probably about 8 the first time I had to ask him, he's now 14 and he struggles. The challenge is to ask that question where you actually want to hear the real answer, not the answer you hope you're going to hear, which is really, really hard to do with people you love. Easy to do in a professional role. Hard to do with the people you love.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. The number to join is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does CEI, helping grow good jobs and shared prosperity with financing, business expertise, and policy solutions. CEIMaine.org.
When two women are married and have a child together, they're not both automatically considered legal parents of that child.
Our law is based on heterosexual, patriarchal circumstances.
To establish legal parenthood, some same-sex couples have to go through a months-long process that can be both expensive and invasive. We meet one such family this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, weekday evenings from 4 to 6:30.
On this week's On the Media, racist ad technology and removal of posts about genocide show the hazards of having no clear code of ethics for the big tech giants like Google and Facebook.
And basically what's happening is they're embarrassed by the press, and they're creating an ethos on the fly as a form of PR.
That and more on the next On the Media from WNYC.
And join us for On the Media tomorrow afternoon at 3.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, suicide prevention, where to go for help if someone you know is considering taking their own life. With me in the studio, Tracy Charette. She's a registered nurse and works with the suicide prevention team at the Togus VA Medical Center. Jenna Maynard is executive director of NAMI Maine. And Lisa Riley is a member of the National American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Chapter Leadership Council and is a certified physician's assistant. She's also chair of the New Hampshire chapter of AFSP and the mentor for the Maine chapter. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Tanya Bailey Curry. She's director of peer and family programs at NAMI Maine. Tanya, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I wondered if you could share with us your personal experience of losing someone to suicide.
Sure. 4.5 years ago now, my smart, handsome, talented, then 21-year-old son, Dante, took his own life. So he had what we thought appeared to be a bright future ahead of him. He was in college, had friends, had his whole life to look forward to. What we didn't know at that time was he was in a really deep, dark place and didn't feel connected to anyone. So the life that we thought he had was far from his own reality. Our family was thrust into kind of what I could say is a world that we weren't prepared for in searching for answers to impossible questions.
Yeah. We've just been talking before you came on mm-hmm. about warning signs and red flags.
Mm-hmm.
But is it fair to say that you weren't seeing those?
At the time, I didn't think that I saw those, but looking back, you know, they say hindsight's 20/20, the signs were right there. I would say look for changes in many forms, appearance, demeanor, sleep habits, giving away of possessions, substance uses, changes in that as well. It could go on and on and on, but looking back, they were all right there. We just did not see them.
Mm. If you had had a sense that something was going on, mm-hmm. would you have been prepared, or would you have known where to go or what to do?
I'm a social work by education, but all of that goes out of the window when it's your family member. So I would love to say that, yeah, I would know exactly where to go, but I really didn't. I felt lost. I felt like I didn't know the first thing to do to look for resources at that time. Luckily for me, I was connected pretty quickly to NAMI Maine, and that opened the door to possibilities of what is now a future for our family.
And we've also talked a little bit about this big question that looms mm-hmm. and is sometimes never answered, which is why. And I wonder, right. Were you stuck on that question, or have you moved past that, and how would you counsel other people who are in your situation to move on?
Yeah, I think that's such a pivotal question. I think that for my family, we were stuck on that why, and sometimes we go back to it. I don't think you get that one aha, here's the answer, this is the moment, now everything is good. You search for it, and what you do is you find supports along the way that teach you how to navigate through life differently. But that's the thing that families are struggling with is, how can this happen? Why did this happen? So it's just an ongoing battle. Absolutely.
Tanya, thank you so much for sharing your story and joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tanya Bailey Curry is Director of Peer and Family Programs at NAMI Maine. We've been talking a lot about focusing on people who might be thinking about suicide. I want to switch a little bit to the survivors now, because here's a family, a woman who's trained in social work, knows well that to look for warning signs, but doesn't see them at the time. This must be really hard for parents who then think, I should have seen it, I could have done something. There must be immense amounts of mixed feelings of guilt and other complicated feelings among survivors.
Yeah, I definitely think that, this is a loss that is very different than any other loss. This is not a loss to cancer or a loss to an accident. there is so much that kind of evolves out of the loss. And speaking from my own experience, when my friend Rita took her life, I knew she was struggling. She was a physician who had taken herself out of practice so she could be hospitalized for care. You know, her depression was so significant. She was having, you know, basically psychotic events. She was not herself. And it was upon her death, all I could think was I a good enough friend? Did I reach out enough? I mean, what I've learned since her passing is a tremendous amount of information. But as a survivor of her loss, I still am struggling with what could I have done different, better for her? So for me, getting involved with an organization like AFSP, like NAMI, any kind of a group where you can share this experience has been of benefit to me. So finding like-minded people who get it, who get the loss. I remember standing in a school doing an education piece many years ago and having a pastor of a church stand up in the audience and literally say out loud, well, obviously that young person who took her life didn't have God in her life. And to sit there as an advocate for change, an advocate for suicide prevention, I was appalled. As a survivor of a loss, I almost passed out.
I think it's hard too when we talk about suicide as preventable and you hear like someone like Tanya talk about how hard it is to really see things and those we love that's that dark and that scary for us and to feel powerless in that moment. And I do think it's important to realize that there are resources to turn to, people to talk to, and also, you know, to recognize that folks are going to struggle. Folks are going to struggle, and to support them through that struggle of the fact that, you know, they may have tried everything they possibly could have in the case of knowing someone was struggling, and that person still may die by suicide. And that guilt, that shame is significant and also increases their risk factor. So we need to really wrap lots of love and support around folks who are touched.
Let's go to the phones. We'll begin with Alex in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate this important discussion. My long-term girlfriend of over 15 years died by suicide 3 years ago, and she suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Beyond all the stigma and the misunderstanding, people say things like, well, you know, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, as if someone in a crisis can just think it through and weigh it out carefully. If someone has a mental illness, they're, by definition, if they're in a crisis, they're not thinking clearly. It's not a matter of making a simple intellectual decision. But beyond that point, I wanted to say that it's not always, in every case, possible to directly question someone whether or not they're suicidal. My girlfriend was on a conditional discharge from New Hampshire State Hospital. And if she displayed any sort of psychological crisis, she would have to go back. So if she admitted that she was suicidal, she would be reincarcerated indefinitely. And only with hindsight did I realize that was a major contributing factor to why she couldn't reach out for help, because she didn't want to lose her dignity, lose her apartment, and be reincarcerated indefinitely for having a crisis. It's a very difficult, nuanced situation. I just wanted to share that.
Alex, thank you very much. Yeah, so the details, we can talk generally about advice on what to do and how to handle this, but the details of circumstance get in the way sometimes.
Right, the reality of Alex's story, his loss, is painfully palpable, especially as it sort of dictates the situation in some of our hospitals and our clinics with regard to how we help. And I'm going to underline the word help, mm-hmm. those struggling and living with a mental illness. I would echo Alex's comment with that. I hate that statement of it's a, you know, permanent solution to a temporary problem. Living with mental illness is not a temporary problem. Maybe the suicidal crisis is temporary, but people struggle every day with mental illness and live. Some live beautiful lives and do well, but this is not something that just goes away. I think Alex's story speaks to the fact that we are far from a really great management of people struggling.
I wanted to ask a question about substance abuse because of this correlation. Is substance abuse a symptom of suicidal thinking, or is it a contributor?
Well, I think that from a mental health perspective, that many folks who live with some type of mental health diagnosis have ended up finding a way to medicate that themselves using a substance. So then obviously they have an underlying issue that then is being treated by substance. And the challenge with substance, at least in the case of, say, law enforcement suicide, twice the suicide rate as the general population, 90% of officer suicide rates involve alcohol use. And so, you know, there's the treating of your underlying mental health challenge, right, as you try to move through that. And then there's the fact that if you use a substance, you often feel that sort of ability to take an action that you wouldn't otherwise take. And so it has both implications in both ways.
It's an increased risk factor, definitely. It's something we look at and how it impairs our judgment and our ability to see things. And like you said, we do see a lot of it where it is a way to help with the pain. And definitely.
On the line with us now is Linda LaJoy. She's the founder of 22 Silhouettes. Linda, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful opportunity. Thank you.
So you created 22 Silhouettes after your son took his life. Tell us about Dustin.
Dustin went into the military right after graduation. I'm trying to remember exactly the date, but I think it was about a month, if that, right after high school graduation. Through high school, he'd been in a law enforcement program. He was all, you know, in his whole senior year, he did the early entry, so he was all set. He was all military. He was, you know, off and running. So he got into the military, was doing, you know, seemed to be doing really well, and he actually extended and re-upped for a little while, longer than his original term, and he went over to Afghanistan. He spent some time over there, and after he came back, you know, we thought he was the same old Dustin, you know. And but of course, again, we're talking about hindsight is 2020. What we're looking at now is he came back from Afghanistan. Within 6 months, he had asked his wife for a divorce. You know, and then once he got out of the military and he was back home here in Maine, I'm thinking, oh, great. Okay, great. He's safe. He's sound. Everything's great. Well, I started seeing his drinking increase. He would have angry outbursts at the drop of a hat when they didn't seem at all warranted. But in between all of those, he was just the normal, happy-go-lucky Dustin he had always been, laughing, you know, at probably inappropriate things, you know, a typical kid. And so I chalked it up to, okay, you know, he was 25 when he got out of the military. I'm thinking, okay, no mother should really know what her 25-year-old son is doing. So, you know, I'll just leave it alone. And, you know, there was sometimes I did have one discussion with him that really kind of sticks with me. And he says, well, I don't have any friends. And I'm like, what do you mean? He was very charismatic. People were drawn to him, and people liked him. Great sense of humor, and could laugh at almost anything, and, you know, and was very caring. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't have any friends? He says, I don't have any friends that understand. And I didn't get it at the time, but of course, since I've lost him, and I've just talked with so many people and so many veterans, I now get what I don't get. You know, I understand that I don't understand. I don't get it. It's beyond the war, too. I mean, he was in Afghanistan. I don't know. He never talked about it, never talked about what he saw, what he did. You know, but it's the whole military environment, the whole atmosphere of being in the military itself is so different from being a civilian. And I never realized that because I was like, oh, my gosh, I was 25. You know, we all live through it. It's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just, like I said, chucked it up to he's sowing some wild oats. He's readjusting. I don't need to see this, you know, and I'm paying too close attention type of thing. You know, and so actually it was quite shocking to find out that he had taken his own life. And what I've found since then, talking with a lot of veterans because I come up with the silhouette project. There's 22 life-size silhouettes, and they're military silhouettes, and they all have a face and a name of a veteran that's lost to invisible wounds. And just talking with veterans, veterans talk to veterans. Veterans don't talk to civilians as easily. And, you know, and unfortunately, I wasn't aware that we have over 400 organizations in the state of Maine that are there to help with veterans. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything from going on a free fishing trip to the VA in Togas, you know, and everything in between, you know, camping trips, hunting trips, help with cars or, you know, things like that. And I feel that maybe if Justin had hooked up with one of these groups and gotten to talk to another veteran that did understand and kind of build that camaraderie, mm-hmm. that maybe he would have made that connection and maybe, you know, and I think what I've been hearing is that that's where people talk, that's where people get, the veterans get more in touch with their feelings and say, okay, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, because that's where they feel safe saying it.
Right, and that's a really important point. We'll talk more about that, but we do have to take a quick break. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
All right, another quick break. When we come back, more on this subject. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Local 188, serving farm-to-table Spanish cuisine since 1999, located in Portland's West End and online at local188.com.
Fear of deportation is real for thousands of people living in New England without documentation. But that fear can also be used as a weapon of domestic violence.
I was afraid every time he did something to me because I couldn't call the police, because he'd say to me that if I called the police, they're going to deport me.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll explore a visa program meant for immigrants who've been targets of crime. I hope you can join us.
And you can join us for Next coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock. The Common Ground Country Fair is underway today in Unity, and Maine Public Radio is there. The Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association annual celebration of rural living brings thousands together to share and explore farming, energy efficiencies, lifestyles, arts, crafts, and livestock. Please stop by the Maine Public booth and say hello. We're located next to the exhibition hall. We're looking forward to hearing from you about our radio, television, and online services. On hand this afternoon at various times are Nora Flaherty, Robin Rylette, and Mark Vogelzang, along with other staff. While supplies last, we may have a few CDs to give away. And if you're an evergreen sustaining friend, we may have a free thank you tote bag. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, suicide prevention. With me in studio, Lisa Riley is with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Jenna Maynard is with NAMI Maine. And Tracy Charette is with the Togas VA Medical Center. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Just a quick follow-up, Tracy, on before the break. Talking about the importance of veterans finding community and how important that is as a preventer.
Absolutely. And I think what Lisa was, which the caller was speaking to is the increased veteran risk. So when veterans get out, they leave this culture and community. And we recognize that there are some real transition challenges that follow. And so to say that relating to others, feeling alone or people don't understand is incredibly common. And so what I would say to veterans listening today, family members, is to realize that there is a big change and there's a shift in how people relate within, you know, as a veteran myself. That's something that I connect with veterans coming in with, is that we have our own speak. We have a way of life that we lived. And it's a very difficult place to transition back into society. And it's met with a lot of angst at times. And I think what I would say is that it's possible to make that transition. It can get better. It's a process. And reaching out, we have incredible peer supports within the VA that can sit and talk on a level that other veterans get it.
Yeah, more on this now with Amy Marcotte, who joins us on the phone. She's director of the Sanford Vet Center and a veteran of the Army's 10th Mountain Division. Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you work with combat vets, and we've been talking here about connecting veterans, making sure they're not alone and isolated. I'm guessing that's important in the work that you do as well.
Very much so. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about is one of the most protective things that veterans can do and family members can do to prevent suicide is connecting with other people. Connecting to a purpose or a cause is really important. And actually, one of the best things that vet centers provide for an opportunity for veterans, we really have a nice community in our vet centers that they can come in and reestablish connections with other veterans and support one another. It's really hard to make that transition from being a part of a team and from being part of a mission that's bigger than themselves to transitioning back into the community where we're very independent-minded, especially here in New England. And so it's very important for them to come in and be able to talk. And as your other callers have mentioned and your panel has mentioned, veterans tend to support one another and tend to seek out one another and bring them into places that are supportive of them. And the other thing I'd mention, too, is that I think it's really important to kind of depathologize and demystify this whole suicide issue, right? That just people who are very sick have suicidal thoughts and that sort of thing. A lot of us end up having suicidal thoughts at some point or another in our lives, and you don't have to meet some sort of mental illness bar in order to experience that. If we can look at suicidal thoughts as kind of like a dashboard warning light that indicates that something needs to be done to get you more support or to take care of some needs, and to kind of destigmatize that as something that is a sign of weakness, but more of just a sign that, you know, you need some buddy support, you need a battle buddy to help you out, or you need just somebody in the community that can support, I think that would be very helpful. Veterans are taught that it's a weakness to say that, you know, you're suffering like that internally. We're supposed to be very tough. So that's one of the things that we do in the VA and in the vet centers is to start right up front about that discussion of, you know, that is a warning sign. There is a lot that can be done to help you get resources if you need them, to be able to talk about things that you've kept to yourself to kind of take some of the pressure off internally. Mm-hmm. So, and I also think that it's important for community members to kind of depathologize it in their own minds. It doesn't have to be a big deal to ask somebody, how are you doing? Are you suffering? I'm concerned about you. Like one of your panelists had said, if we see this as a big boogie monster of an issue, we're going to avoid talking about it. And I think we just really need to normalize the discussion of suicide.
Yeah. Only a couple of minutes left, but Amy, I wanted to thank you for joining us. Amy Marcotte, director of the Sanford Vet Center and a veteran of the Army's 10th Mountain Division. Now, you have centers in Portland, Sanford, Bangor, Caribou, and Lewiston.
That's right.
Okay, and the number is 1-877-WAR-VETS if you want to reach out. So I appreciate you joining us today.
I just want to echo that her statement that we need to normalize. We all have physical health. We all have mental health. And being able to talk about mental health and take care of our mental health is really where the conversation needs to start. Not that it necessarily means you have an illness to find yourself in that point, I think is a critical, critical piece of information.
1 minute left. If you were going to give people a place to go who were after this conversation, we'll start with you, Jeff.
Yeah. So 622-5767, NAMI Maine is funded by the state of Maine to provide an information referral line for everything and anything to do with mental health. We will refer you to every resource we know in the state of Maine related to mental health. NAMIMaine.org is our website. And we really exist in every nook and cranny. We are in Aroostook County, in Washington County, Franklin County. We cover the whole state, and we happen in your local community. So find us, and we're there for you.
Lisa?
AFSP.org. Learn where you can connect with other survivors. Learn where you can take a training. We love to collaborate with NAMI organizations and our veteran partners. This is all about saving lives and reaching out to those who've suffered a loss. So learn more, take a training, and be the voice.
Yeah. Tracy?
Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255, and press option 1. This is for veterans, service members, family members, and friends. It can also get you connected to your local suicide prevention coordinator. We can help you navigate the VA system, get you set up with other care that you might need. So please reach out.
All right. Tracy, Lisa, Jenna, thank you all for joining us
today.
Thank you, Keith.
Tracy Charette works with the Suicide Prevention Team at the Tokas VA Medical Center. Jenna Maynard is Executive Director of NAMI Maine. Lisa Riley is a member of the National American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's Chapter Leadership Council and is a certified physician's assistant. John Keimel ran the board today, and we also had help from Cindy Hahn. Jonathan Smith is the producer of Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Have a good afternoon.